and welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I'm your host, Tom Donnelly, and this is round 13, turn 3, and I am here with one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. I am here with the opinionated gamer himself, Mr. Ben Mandelker. How are you, sir?
Hi, Tom. Wow, I didn't realize I was already, like, I had leveled up into
way up there.
One of your favorites of all time. That's exciting.
Way up. You know that when you come, it's a party.
Oh.
You know that you bring the party to game night.
I actually don't know that, but
you should know that. Then let's sing it loud. You were probably one of the quickest people we've ever between meeting and adopting us into our Game Brain crew. You were probably the quickest, you know, package to plate.
Wow, thank you.
You and Candace both. You and Candace were both, like, the moment we met, you two were like, oh, totally. Like, it wasn't even, we want you to be on the podcast. It's, we want to see you every week.
Oh, thank you. I'm like, I feel like there's an asterisk, which is, it all depends on how well-fed I am when I show up. If I'm not well-fed, there may not be as much of a party.
Listen, everybody has those things, right? I mean, Dimitri is the most food-sensitive, right?
Like, I haven't experienced that side of him, actually. I've not experienced hangry Dimitri.
Well, I mean, type 1 diabetes is a serious thing.
Oh, yeah. So it's more than just hanger.
No, it messes with your head. It really does in some serious ways. So no shade on Dimitri. That's a medical condition. And when that blood sugar changes rapidly, things happen.
They're
not in your control. So
absolutely. I mean, we know it just being hangry. You see how much you can be affected and how, like, sensitive for me I become. I find if I'm starting to have arguments in my head, with, like, fictional arguments with people that I know in my head, I'm like, wait a second, have I eaten something recently? And usually I haven't.
Yeah, 1846 at the con, I remember.
That was 1862.
1862 at the con. And then I was like, uh-oh, nobody fed Ben. This is bad.
I was not fed, but I went and I fed myself, and I saved myself from turning into a gremlin.
So how are you doing, man? What's going on with you?
I'm great, thank you. Everything is, you know, everything's, like, pretty much the same. I'm just, like, floating through this sort of quasi post-pandemic, but not really post, sort of, like, I don't know what this Delta variant world is, but I'm just floating through it. And, you know, my parents came to town last week, which was great. They hadn't been out here to California since the pandemic, so it was really great to have them out here. And it was wonderful. Although when the parents come to town, I actually don't get to board game as much. So I was like a pent up animal.
You guys want to know what a sweetie Ben is? Here's how much a sweetie is. His parents were worried because of the pandemic and all that sort of stuff. And so he self-quarantined essentially for 3 weeks. Prior to and during his parents' visit.
Yeah, it was like a semi-quarantine. Like, I would go out, like, I was fine to you know, interact with people outdoors or with masks on.
Right.
It was really at my mom's request. You
yeah,
know,
you were
when
asked
you have a Jewish mother.
Eat,
yes.
Don't go out and eat at a restaurant.
Which, so we were at a restaurant together, in fact. We were at a restaurant semi indoors, and my mom called and said, by the way, Ben, when we come out, we just want to ask you not to, you know, like, make sure you're wearing a mask out in public and don't do a lot of indoor dining. And I was, like, literally in a restaurant. I was like, sure, Mom, starting tomorrow.
And then a couple days later, you saw a picture of your mom and dad at a restaurant in New York City.
No, they were at a restaurant the night before in New York City. I was like, Mom. No, but I'm a slave to Jewish guilt. And so
You're a good boy.
I'm a good Jewish boy.
Yes.
And so I, you know, I sort of, like, I wouldn't say I locked myself in, but I didn't come to game night. And I was very upset because, retroactively upset, because you guys were playing a lot of Panamax during that window. And I love Panamax. And I never get to play it. And you guys have actually been playing a whole bunch of games that I've really wanted to play. And
Versailles,
so
1919.
I want to, based on Candace's rave, I want to play that.
Yes.
Alubari, you guys have been busting out. Every time Alubari comes out, I always have another game that I have to play or something like
that's,
that.
That's true. That's true. And some of us sometimes go out to dinner before our game nights. And we purposely picked your favorite restaurants while you were...
You went to the father's office, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, we did.
Wow. I'm like, I may leave the podcast now because I haven't actually been there. Like, there's no pandemic excuse. I haven't been there in, like, 3 or 4 years, and I love their burger.
Yes. widely considered to be the beginning of the gourmet burger
trend. I would say it is. I would actually say it was the beginning of the gourmet burger trend, at least in LA.
And Paul, even though Paul does not like the burger particularly much, he acknowledged that it was the burger that launched a million $20 burgers.
We would not have the umami burger or really so many of these burgers
100%.
Without it.
And I and you still love it. I think that burger is still
delish.
One of the best things.
If you come to LA, go to the father's office and get the burger, but just know you cannot change a single thing about it. They will not accept it.
Do not ask for ketchup when we were there.
You cannot.
When we were there, Paul said, Dimitri, would you, when you see the person come by, will you just ask for some ketchup? And I laughed. And Dimitri said, yes, of course. And he was about to raise his hand and get somebody's attention. I said, Dimitri, put your hand down. He's like, what?
Yeah, they will not. And in fact, thank God for the Culver City location, because the original one in Santa Monica was a nightmare. It was like a closet, and you couldn't reserve a table.
Yep.
And you just had to go and stand over people and glare at them until they left their table. And it was actually ruined the burger temporarily, but now it's great.
I lived at Montana and Euclid while that was going on. Mm. I was four short blocks from that amazing burger and had it all the time. And this was in the time before the Culver City location opened.
Yeah.
So it was,
that was the thing.
There were people, I saw people from Pasadena that and by the way, that's an hour and a half at certain times a day to get there, that we're willing to wait for an hour, 2 hours to get
anytime it. You're willing to cross the 405 in Los Angeles to get to anything is a significant sacrifice.
Oh man. Yeah, well, I'm glad that your parents had a good time and you guys had a good time together.
Yeah, we had a great time, and I was very happy to have them here, but I've also been very happy to dive back into board games.
Excellent. Excellent. That was very diplomatically put.
They're not gamers. I wish they were gamers. I played some games with them. I once brought some little games back to New York.
Sure.
And I found success with a fake artist goes to New York.
Okay.
Actually, with them.
Right.
That caused a lot of laughter and no thanks.
Right.
And
yes.
I did play. Did I play Lords of Vegas with my dad once? I don't know. Like, you know, if I can rope in my nephew and then put gaming under the guise of this is valuable time that they get to spend with their grandchild,
yeah,
they are much more open to gaming.
I find that for that generation, and I'm not sure if your parents or my parents are the same generation, but I think they probably are. They grew up without, you know, a lot of them without televisions or without, you know, televisions that were on all the time or stuff like that. They had very few distractions. So they were actually used to playing cards. Mm-hmm. They were used to playing parlor games, like at parties and stuff. They would bring out parlor games. And so there is some surprising games that you can get your parents to play. Like,
yeah. I think card games is the right strategy for
100%. Any card-based game, so no thanks, but lots of other card-type games you can get them to play, but also parlor games. Like, I would do for Thanksgiving or Christmas, when we would have like the big family over, like everybody, we would play Werewolf.
Mm.
And the parents are like, could not be quicker to understand the game and quicker into it. Like, no foot dragging, no nothing. It's like, it was games that they used to play when they were younger that everyone would do. It's like who's got the doily?
And who's got the doily? Oh, that's a classic game. I love Who's Got the Doily.
I have no idea what the names of those games were back then, but it's like that, where you have to figure out.
The hoop with the stick that they're chasing down the street.
No, more like you have like I'm looking around here. We're all, you know, all the adults are drinking. The kids are hanging around waiting to play again. And you're playing a game, and the game is you get to ask, you know, two people, two questions, and whoever the first person to figure out the person that has the hidden thing or whatever. It was social deduction games. That's like an ancient thing.
You're right. And I mean, growing up, I mean, I played actually a lot of Stratego with my dad.
Yeah.
I remember playing, I think, Gin Rummy. I played card games with my mom. So I think maybe next time I go back to New York or they come out here, maybe I will maybe try to do like a family card night, because I think the strategy games, my parents are smart. They're with it and everything. My dad's a lawyer. My mom is a publicist. So they're like, they take in new information well. But I've also found that there's a difference between taking in information around about the world around you versus wanting to learn like rules. And some people, I feel like they're just kind of like, this is just not what I've gotten to this age, and this is not what I want to. I know what I want to do with my time,
correct,
and how I want to use my brain, and this is not how I want to use my brain.
100%.
But I think a card game is accessible, and in fact, so my boyfriend's parents are much more into games, etc. But they're not. I wouldn't say they're like big into like strategy games, but we've had a huge amount of success, and throughout the pandemic, a huge amount of success with Six Nimmt.
Yep.
First of all, that has been a success with literally everyone I know. Like
it's
that
it's
is
a very good game. It's just a genuinely great game.
It is. It's a great game. It's easy. It's fun. It like you. It's kind of like a crapshoot. You're just kind of like guessing the entire time, but it's theatrical and silly, and everyone goes, oh. And
there's a little bit of press your luck to it.
There's, you could sort of things, but there was a period of time during the pandemic or during the quarantine. Yeah. I don't like to put it in the past tense, but when things were really at their peak, we're doing like a game afternoon. Let me do like an hour and a half of Six Nimmt with my boyfriend and his mom and his sister. And it was like, it was a very easy teach. And so I think that might be a really fun one for my parents.
100%.
Too.
Yeah. I would also say other games you might want to consider. I think The Crew is a card. It is a card game. At the end of the day, it's a card game. And once they understand how it's played, they're like, oh, I get this. It's kind of like bidding and bridge to some degree, right? To figure out how to make this happen.
Stick'em might be a good one, too. Yeah.
Arboretum.
Yes. I think could Arboretum will be a little bit more up their alley.
Maybe.
I think it would be. I think.
And Tichu is.
I still want to play Tichu. Oh. I have it. I played it on the app, and it was. I want to play like a real. I want to have a teacher night where it's like four of us and we play for like 2 hours. Because I hear that's kind of what happens when you play. You just sort of start, you know, you have a beer or whatever, or wine, and you just sort of are just playing but involved.
Yes. 100% involved. My wife and I are just
you guys are big teacher masters.
Terrors.
Right? Yeah. Terrors. Okay. I'm not going to start with you guys. No offense. I'm going to start with like equally like
maybe bring your boyfriend and I partner with your boyfriend and you partner with my wife or something like
quite
that.
Possibly.
Something like that. Something like we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. But yeah, you need to learn the joys of teacher because it is the ultimate partner game.
Yeah.
It is wonderful.
I also want to play it because. I have taught myself the rules multiple times, but I never actually play it to really sort of like lock them in. And I kind of also just want to have that lock in the rules thing because the rules, they seem actually not that difficult, but for some reason they do not stick in my brain. They're like not sticky rules. There's like enough weird little things that I'm like, huh, what, huh?
What I do is when I teach the game, I teach it in three rounds. So the first round, we just play no special cards. We just play with you're counting up the points that you're getting when you take the tricks. That's it. Second game, we play with you can call Tichu and you're playing for an extra 100 points. You can call Grand Tichu, you're playing for an extra 200, right? And if you go out first and second, you guys get 200 points, period, right? And so we just play with that.
Yeah.
So then instead of just going for the 10 and 5 point cards, you're going for maybe bigger points and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the third round, we add in the four special cards and everybody's ready to go.
Because
you're right. It's not a hard game to understand, but if you learn it in those three layers, it works so much better.
Yeah, some games have like a little bit of a stickiness issue with rules that like they shouldn't be hard. It might be something I might mention in our review a little bit later. There were a few little things in the game we're going to review today that I had minor stickiness.
Well, should we talk about that?
Let's dive in. I have a lot of things to say about today's episode, and I'm really excited to get into them. So I'm sorry, I'm already starting my usual process of derailing the podcast, talking about something completely different, which in this case are parent games.
So, yeah. So Ben's, you guys know, right? You guys listen to the episode. When you see that it's a Ben episode, you know that in 1 hour, you're going to be done, right? It's definitely not going to run long.
Comedy is in brevity, and I consider myself a great comedian. So,
we are going to be talking about the 2021 release of Mind Management, a hidden movement game. And then, because we're talking about hidden movement, Ben and I are going to talk about other uncommon game mechanisms. Because hidden movement is a pretty small subset, right?
It seems. I'm sure there are big like hidden movement circles, people who really love it, who would be like, "What are you talking about?" But I think that generally speaking.
But gun to your head, I'm not sure you could name 10 games that have that.
Yeah, it's not like up there like worker placement.
Correct, exactly. So we're going to talk about some mechanics that we don't see all the time and talk about some of our favorites. Mm-hmm. And even come up with a top five list. But let's say we get right to it by talking about game night.
Yeah.
For me, I played some Babylonia outside of game night. I tried Quest with some people. I played some Terraforming Mars. And then we had a, I think, nine-person game night.
Nine people.
Yep, last night. Including Mike Nikoloff from BGG's Game Night,
who was, yeah,
was invited by Jennifer to come on by, and he was a delight. We had a really fun time with him.
We did have a fun time. It was nice. You know, it's just so funny. Like, I know this guy. How do I know him? And you think, did I go to a dinner party? Did I meet him? Was he in a commercial? And I was like, oh yeah, he's on Game Night on BGG. I mean, that's like the most LA thing to be like, do I know you from my life, or are you just in a commercial?
Right. Exactly. Are you on my TiVo, or...
It does happen. Like, there was one time I fully walked up to someone, and, like, she was sitting with someone who I happened to know, and I gave her a hug, and I was like, oh, my God, hi, how are you? I haven't seen you in so long. She's like, hi, how are you? Da, 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 da.
Oh, no.
And then I was like, after I could not place who she was, and then I realized she was actually... A judge on Top Chef Masters.
Oh my God.
I just hugged a judge from Top Chef Masters
because
I
thought she was my Cora.
But like, it was like, we both really thought we knew each other, and she apparently asked my friend the same thing, and we realized we do not know each other whatsoever.
That's so that's our segment. That's So LA. That is a Ben Mandelker special episode that we do from time to time. So the three games we played, because we split up into three tables of three, we played Alubari, Versailles 1919 for a second go, and of course, Mind Management. I think everybody had a really good time.
Sounded like it. It was very raucous. Well, not raucous, but it was a lively evening. It sounded like everyone was having a nice time.
Yeah. The folks playing Alubari, two of them had never played it before, and that's a great game to introduce to. It's a really good game. I mean, you must have played it 100 times, Ben, right? I mean, obviously, we're about to never play it again because we played it so much.
You know what, Tom? Let's not test our friendship in this way.
At Versailles 1919, Candace ran that session, and we love that. We love that game. That's a really interesting, not a perfect game. Trey pointed out that to some extent you're not really thinking about it becomes athematic because the strategy ignores that and is about what am I gaining and what am I losing?
Right, like about how like. I didn't really understand. I've never played the game, so I don't really understand what he meant when he said this, but I sort of felt like I understood. He was like, well, should like Britain care about doing something with the Middle East? And in his game, Britain didn't care at all, but like it somehow didn't. Okay, I'm just butchering what Trey said, and I know he's getting angry.
It is. What it is that in the game, there are issues, and when they come up, the game kind of pushes you to care about certain things more than other things, right? And each power is asymmetric because the nature of the issues coming up are going to push them towards certain strategies or away from other strategies. But depending on how your game goes, that can change fairly radically. And you're not really thinking about what you're doing so much as thinking about what does this do to the slide? What does this do to... the unrest in the Middle East. What does this do to the unrest in the Pacific, right? And that's really what you're thinking about more than anything, which still is kind of thematic, but I get his point.
Interesting. I definitely want to try it based on Candace's raves. I'm actually playing with Candace tomorrow. I'm playing Friedrich tomorrow with Candace. And and she proposed maybe doing Versailles afterwards, but there's also a chance we may do Tragedy Looper instead, speaking of...
Ooh,
hidden movement-esque things.
It is a hidden movement game. It's a hidden movement, hidden trader, hidden everything game.
It's a game that down the line I actually 100% want to review for this podcast because I think it's actually a very, very special game.
You and I are probably two people of 20 that own a copy in all of Los Angeles, I'm guessing.
Well, they were everywhere. I actually once went to Miniature Mart. I was in St. Louis, and so I went to Miniature Mart, and they had a stack of Tragedy Loopers that was like as high as my shoulder. It was like on sale for $15 each. And talk about a tragedy. It's a tragedy that game did not, like, that could even be, like, not, those cannot be bought out, because I think it's a wonderful game with some flaws.
Do not derail the podcast.
Okay.
Because the truth is that I could talk for an hour about why, because it's very Japanese. It's a very Japanese game. You're trying to figure out what horrible thing happened, and you're trying to prevent it. And the horrible things are very K-pop.
Well, it's anime.
Like
it's anime.
Korean drama or anime, right? You know what I mean? It's like very...
Some people who feel like, oh, they're not into anime will think like, oh, I'm not going to be into this game. I mean, I don't really care about anime. But you know what, though? I'm going to save it. In the interest of the podcast, I'm going to save it for when we review Tragedy Looper, because I actually think it's a game that is really, really worth highlighting, and it doesn't really have the attention that it deserves.
And if there are tons of cheap copies out there, it's probably something worth our review. But yeah, I think we can suffice it to say Ben and I both like the game.
Yeah. So in terms of my game night, I've played some interesting games. Jennifer and I played about 2/3 of a game of Imperial Steam, which is coming out from Capstone. Mm-hmm. We played it online, just the two of us, just sort of to play around with it. I thought it was fantastic. I loved it.
Really?
It was great. It's hard. Like, it's, you know, it's route building, and it's, you need this and you need that, and you run out of, it's like money goes out, and there's lots of interesting things going on, but I thought it was a very game brain game for our group.
Cool.
So I definitely recommend for people who are interested to try that out on tabletop simulator. I've been in we're going on to week two or so, maybe two, maybe three, I don't know. But Paul and friend of the podcast, James, and I, we've been playing 1817 on 18xx.games.
Oh boy, did I hear some stories about this.
What? Oh, wait, tell me what you've been hearing. Because this is my favorite 18xx game, and it's full of so much drama.
I heard that there was a request for somebody to back up their turn and to do something different for the unity and good feelings of the room. That's
there
what
was
I heard.
That okay. So this has been an extraordinary game, because last time I played with Paul and James, so James came to game night a few weeks ago.
James
is super sharp. He is a great player.
Yeah.
And we like to say that James is microchip clever, because he just has like a microchip in his brain. And Paul is wedge clever, because a wedge is a simple machine. And I'm stick clever, because I'm just a stick. I'm not even a machine. I'm just a stick that you can poke things at. So the last time the three of us played, the microchip just destroyed us, and I made all these errors, and I came in so far behind. Like, I had like $5 at the end.
Right.
But even though I'm just a stick, I decided I was going to learn from my mistakes, and I changed things up, and I had a very strong opening act one of 1817. And so I became public enemy number one, because I had a lot more value and everything.
Sure.
So they tried to short the hell out of me. And because in that game you can short shares. I'm not going to get into it, because we will talk about this game again down the line.
But then James was getting the better part of that deal. And Paul said, hey, you got to cut me in or no deal. Bad things are going to happen.
And James was like, I think it for me, they had some situation where Paul was like, listen, since I'm helping you with your plan, I would like this in return. And James was like, I don't think that's in my best interest. So then Paul decided he was going to create chaos, as he does. And then after the chaos was created, which was wonderful chaos because it really benefited me, there was a realization that this may be a classic feel-bad moment for James. So we kind of just like, we pulled it back a little bit, which was great, actually, because it's been more of a challenge for me to like stave off these people trying to attack me with their shorting me. And it's been a drama-filled session, but it's been incredibly fun and very tense. I'm like checking that website every day, like every half an hour. So I played that. I also played, I want to also mention a shout out to the Train Shuffling podcast, because back in June, I played a several week long, game of 1860, now I forget, was it 63, whatever, Russia,
right?
Russia. Okay. It's like 63, 67. I think it may have been 61.
I don't know.
I think it was 61. Either way. So I played it with Eric from Train Shuffling and some other people. So I want to give a shout out to them for a very fun game where I came in. My stick presence. I fulfilled my stick destiny, which was coming in at the end.
Coming in last?
I was terrible. Yeah, I had never played the game. It was a disaster.
Listen, the stick was the first tool, my friend.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right. You may not be the best, but you were the first.
Yeah.
And guess what? They still give gold medals at the Olympics for that. All right.
That's right. I'm going to get to the Olympics as a little stick.
All right. Crows, that's their tool of choice. right? Monkeys, that's what they use.
That's right. I mean, you wouldn't have the opening sequence of 2001 Space Odyssey.
You would not.
Without a stick.
Nor one of the best form cuts.
Or a bone.
Nor one of the best form cuts in the business as we jump millions of years in the future.
Yeah.
So exactly. Good.
Yeah,
so
although good. I think that was more of a bone than a stick, but...
It was a bone.
It could have been a stick.
Look, a bone is a stick.
Yeah, I mean,
let's
just
be clear.
It's just proximity. I mean, it's like a synonym, right?
Precisely.
If that monkey had been near a stick, it would have probably had the similar. It had to be a sturdy stick, of course.
But, of course.
You know, it can't just be a twig.
Naturally. Shall we get to the news?
Yeah.
Let's get to the news.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Office, South American. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to press
flight. We don't have a ton of game news, but we do have some interesting things. Capstone has announced pre-orders for a game called Corrosion, and man, that looks interesting to me.
Yeah, it looks funky. I'm seeing gears and machines. I sort of do. Speaking of things that are mechanisms, no pun intended. I do like games where you can make your own little machine and it does things. You know, it sounds like this. What this game is about?
I don't always like those games because the more you're making your own machine, the more you're kind of multiplayer solitaire a little bit, right? The more you're focused on your little player mat, it's like, why not just play an app, right?
Yeah.
Why play that game? But what I like about this is that it's all about the rust, right? It's all about corrosion. So you on your turn are either playing engineers, which are going to get you new machines, or better engineers so you can do better things and upgrade better things, or you are turning the corrosion wheel. You're turning the wheel that is going to make your machines work, that's going to bring you your workers, your engineers back to you, but it's also going to rust things. It's going to break these things down. So... it seems like the game is going to be about trying to flog your cheap, junky tech, getting what you can from it, but upgrading at the right moment so that before it all falls apart, right? And that's a lot of market timing, right? That's a lot. I love that idea.
That's fun. I like the idea that hopefully the game sort of goes in this direction where, like, by the end, you feel like you have this, like, basement full of machines that you have, like, duct tape around them and, like, just, like, things, like, just you're just trying to keep it together, you know?
Well, there is a deluxe version that has actual metal gears that you can use and put into your machine, which sounds great. I mean, it reminds me of Zolkin. Zolkin has actual gears.
Yes, real gears
that you're using. A little bit of Barrage because
the wheel.
There's the wheel. So I think we've been moving toward a game like this for a long time. And let's face it, nobody's making better games these days than Capstone. Capstone is
they do great work. Although I actually am always a little wary of things like Metal Gears, and I'll tell you why. I kickstarted the deluxe version of Dinosaur Island a few years ago.
Oh no!
Yeah,
Pandasaurus is not. Yeah,
the components were great, but it was like metal this, metal that, and the box weighs like 500 pounds, and it's a pain. It is a pain, and so like sometimes I'm like, keep in mind, everyone, that when you get metal stuff, things get really heavy, and like that can be oddly impactful when you carry things in a tote bag or wherever. So just keep that in mind.
That's a good point. And you know my point of view on components.
Yes.
I don't really care.
I actually don't care that much either. I've started to have fun with getting, you know, gussied up things. But my whole feeling is the game has to be good. And then if the game is good, then if it has good components and immersion or whatever, then it's like, then it takes it to a sort of a new level.
Yeah.
And if a game is bad, then I'm sort of forced to look at, be like, okay, well, how do these components look? Oh, the components aren't good either. Okay, well, then this is a problem.
Yeah, I agree with that. Next up, we have Twilight Struggle news. The Red Sea conflict in the Horn of Africa has a cover. Jason Matthews tweeted about it and showed us what it is. And they're calling it the Lunchtime Series of Games, which I love that term.
I like it too, but I think it's so funny to think of like a casual lunchtime conflict about the Red Sea.
Look, it's definitely not going to be casual, but it is. But if it can be played in an hour, if in an hour you can adjudicate, you know, the Somali pirates and, you know, the tensions in the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, like, I'm all about it. I'm like, hey, heck yeah.
That is a lunch.
Sign me up. Listen, Twilight Struggle takes a while.
It does.
It is not a short game. So if you can give me a bite-sized thing that even somewhat approximates that experience,
absolutely,
100% in, right?
Yeah.
100%. Kickstarter has announced that a Masters of the Universe Clash for Eternia board game is due to be coming out from, who else? Simon Games.
Mm.
Oh boy. Were you a He-Man the Masters of the Universe guy?
I'm not going to say I didn't have a crush on He-Man, but
I understand.
I mean, as a little closeted gay boy, I have to say, like, the idea of this muscle-clad tanned dude in like a loincloth. No, I loved He-Man. I love those action figures and everything, but you know, I'm not someone who is always won over by nostalgia plays when good. It comes to most things,
yeah.
You know, unless it's the Golden Girls. Like, even the Golden Girls, like, if there's a Golden Girls Simon game, I might have to get that. But generally speaking, like, I'm happy for the people who are going to be excited about this game.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be
Fantasy Flight
me.
Is doing the Golden Girls game, by the way. Yeah.
I do have Golden Girls Trivial Pursuit, but someone gave that to me.
Yeah, I never got into the He-Man. I didn't get it. It wasn't something that was really interesting to me. The comic, the cartoon, and so on and so forth when I was young, never really spoke to me. The movie didn't move my needle at all.
Yeah. I mean, I loved the action figures. I didn't have much, but my neighbor had a whole bunch, right? Because I was like, there was that one neighbor who had all the toys. So you go over to his house. He had all the Nintendo games. And I loved, like, I had a Castle of Grayskull, I think, which was cool, but everyone wants the Skeletor castle because it had a microphone, and I loved all that. But, you know, I think in terms of, like, I'll be on a wait and see. If it's actually an actual good game, then I'm totally open to it. But for right now, it does not inherently move the needle for
evidently
me.
Evidently, there's a lot of debate about the Kevin Smith animated He-Man show that's come out right now. I don't know enough about it to speak intelligently, except that people seem to be very upset that the story focuses on Valeria and not on He-Man, if that's her name. I'm not sure.
Well, I haven't seen it, but actually a friend of mine works at Netflix, and he sort of shepherded that project. He's a huge Masters of the Universe fan. Like, he is hugely into it, and he was very, very, very proud of that project, and he's really excited about it. So I don't know, but I'm happy for him, and he is very excited that it is about Valeria and has a different POV.
Yeah, and a lot of the reviews were very good.
I thought the reviews were good.
Yeah.
I do want to check that out, because, you know, it's hard to give up your old crushes.
Absolutely. Speaking of old crushes, there's a designer named Manny Vega. He did the Sparkle Kitty series, and you and I have never played Sparkle Kitty. I shouldn't
speak
for you.
That may have eluded me.
I shouldn't speak for you, but it is a phenomenon.
Is it really?
Sort of in the Exploding Kittens way of things and that sort of thing. There's a game called Flamecraft that he's putting out, which is a game that is kind of cute dragons.
Okay.
It looks a little... don't know too much about it yet, but it's a magical realm. A village awakes, artisanal dragons make coffee and cakes and stuff like that. It feels a little bit...
Wait, did you say artisanal dragons make coffees and cakes?
Yep, or artisan dragons make coffees and cakes.
Either way,
it is.
Do they have mustaches and, like, suspenders?
I don't know. I don't know if they have drive-thrus. I don't know how much of this is Food Chain Magnate, and I don't know how much of this is Everdell. But it does feel a little Everdell looking at it. It's pastels. It's kind of like colors. And for people, you know, for people in the Sparkle Kitty universe and stuff like that, this looks like a step up to a Euro game. So if you have any, like,
love that,
super light gamers that might want to step up to the next thing, when Flamecraft comes out, you should definitely take a look at that, because
it might just
be a gateway game for a different audience, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll see. And then, favorite thing. Ben, do you remember what the number one game of the Game Brain Top 50 was?
I do believe it was Great Western Trail.
Twas indeed.
Yeah.
Twas ever so. Great Western Trail has a second edition that is coming out, and we are starting to hear things about it. Would you like to know what the changes are?
I would. I love Great Western Trail, and I'm actually a little annoyed that there's a second edition, because I don't want to have to rebuy it, and I fear that I may have to rebuy it.
Well, let us let's go issue by issue, and you tell me whether or not we'll both say
I love this. Whether or not this is, let's right? do this.
Here
yes.
we go. Okay, so first thing, brand new artwork by Chris Quilliams. What is that? We're on your must buy maybe, or don't care that much about that. What is that?
Where's
that?
I actually really like the art in Great Western Trail. I've seen some of the art in the new one on like the box cover, which I think box cover looks fantastic, mm-hmm. but not worth it. It's not like for me, the Castles of Burgundy when they revamped, I actually did get the new one because I thought the other one was just actually so ugly. I wanted, but here, so far my needle has not moved.
100%. I could not agree more. I think the original art is not amazing, but it is exactly what lovely. It should be. It's gorgeous. It's yeah. fantastic. The cattle cards all look
they're
great,
cute.
And everything
it's
is
just
the way
the guys that the guys on the cover, and even the guys. I still don't understand why they went with that cover for Great Western Trail. They could have used some more diversity.
100%. That's exactly my point. I think they could have used more diversity, and they don't have it. So, second thing, solo mode.
It doesn't do anything for me, but that's for other people. That's cool.
Same here. Maddie's going to buy it because there's a solo mode. I don't care. I'm not going to play this game solo. Dual layered player boards.
I like that. I didn't really have too much of an issue with those player boards. Like, it wasn't like, Terraforming Mars, which is like the poster child of why you need it, where you have all sorts of stuff going on. Like, I think if you move stuff around on that player board by accident, it's pretty easy to remember like where stuff goes.
If you just keep saying the things that I want to say, this is not going to be a good segment.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's you're not putting little cubes in places. No, you're putting actual tiles down. They're significant. Mm-hmm. You could bump the table and you know exactly where things go. It's not it's not really needed.
Yeah. I think maybe more so for Maracaibo, but you know.
Yes.
But you know.
A new breed of cows, the Simmental breed.
I mean, that's cool. So this is now where things start to change a little bit because like, I'm like, I don't really need to buy a whole board game for a new breed of cows. But then I think, but what do those cows do for the game?
Yeah.
We're playing the newly board game, right? Board game. Newly board game.
Exactly. You tell me new cows, I'm like, damn it, I think I got to buy this.
It's like, does this mean there's a new mechanism? Is there a new, like, what's happening?
Well, it changes the math. It changes the equation. It changes the how you figure this out. And I don't know if the cows are they more expensive? Are they, do they do something?
And keep in mind, I've already invested in the expansion too. So like I've put money into this. Not only have I put money into it, but my expansion was missing a piece. So I also emailed Egert Spiel or whoever it was and 3 months later I finally got the little piece that was missing. So I have the investment of like this process of getting that piece.
100%.
You know, so this is like to get rid of it is not a light task.
How about two new reversible buildings, building number 11 and 12?
That's annoying. It is. I know. I feel like you're playing a game
things.
With. I feel like you're this. I feel like you knew all along you were going to send me down this path.
Well, it's weird because I am literally doing it in BGG order, but BGG order parallels for both you and I think, our rising interest in things.
I like a new building.
Yep. 12 exchange tokens. These are the exchange tokens from Rails of the North expansion that you can now play without the expansion.
That does not, because I already have the expansion, so it's not an issue. Aha! Gotcha.
Ah! And last but not least, and I don't know what this means, 4 new master tiles added for more. Oh, I know what master tiles are. Okay, I get this. 4 new master tiles for more strategy, replayability, and challenges.
Oh,
what do you think master tiles?
Master
means?
Tiles for more strategy. Is it like maybe a root thing, or
I think it's the start tiles.
Oh,
right. You have the grays, the grays that go down. Imagine 4 new ones, and you randomize what start tiles are even out there.
That kills me because
it changes the replayability so much.
Yeah, well, I will say this also. Yeah. I feel like I did see somewhere along the way, maybe a few weeks ago, they're also changing the teepees. So the Native Americans and teepees, I think that they are changing that to something like robbers or some the taking away that element. Because I know some people actually found that to be a little problematic.
Well, when you're being penalized for meeting the natives, essentially, is kind of what they're talking about, the Native Americans. That is a problem, right?
Yeah, so I think I believe they changed that. And then I feel like I saw somewhere, and don't quote me on this, but I feel like I saw somewhere that there was, they may have adjusted that path. So on the original one, where the teepees are, is an actual route.
Yeah.
That I think I've maybe seen someone go down that path like once. Because
extremely,
like you said,
rarely. Yeah. It's,
you know, and so maybe I feel like I heard that they have increased the incentive to go that path.
Okay. Good.
Which is actually, that is kind of really good.
It's kind of really good.
But like that, this may be fake news. Maybe I'm just like making it up.
Look, look, they have done their job. Okay. They have given us just enough that you and I are probably going to buy the second edition.
I love Great Western Trail, and I haven't played it enough recently.
It's a classic game. We haven't brought it out in forever.
I still remember the first time I played it and just like how my heart just like, you know, when you play a game that you just know you love and will love forever.
Yeah.
And that just like my heart, like I was like, I love this game. I love this game. And I continue to love it.
I call it the tuning fork moment, right? It's like, ding, yeah. And it just resonates with you. And you're like, oh yeah, I just love this. Yeah.
Yep.
100%. That's it for the news.
That's good news.
That was some good news, or at least we ended with some good news. Let's talk about our games on the brain. What is on your brain, Ben?
Two games on the brain. One's like a little bit of a cheat, and also I'll keep it quick. I love Big Brother, the TV show.
Sure.
And,
I mean, who doesn't?
Just people who respect.
I don't.
People who respect themselves. But, I was just thinking about it because I was watching an episode, and someone was like just trying to save themselves from like going up on the block or being voted out. So hardcore. And it reminded me so much of the social deduction games we play. And I realized that, like, you know, one of the appeals of watching that game is it is kind of like a big old social deduction game on TV in a certain way.
100%. You know? Yeah.
So that, you know, I was just reflecting on that. So that was like a little bit on my brain. But in terms of actual board games, we already talked about Elubari. So the only other game I think I've thought about recently has been Crescent City Cargo, which we played. And I still want to get some more plays in it, but gosh, I have to say I'm a little disappointed with it.
I am too. It's like all the decisions end up being kind of small ball, you know. It's like it's I wonder if the trains are not a little, they're the outlier, they're the ones that aren't on the hamster wheel, and because of that there might be some problems there, and everything else is just, yeah, it doesn't spark my imagination.
It doesn't. Like I actually don't have a problem with the trains. I think there's like some really cool thoughts that go into it. It's fun to sequence your action. I gotta do this before this, whatever. But the having the you talked about it on a few episodes ago, that you have to reset your morale. You have every action you do, almost every action you do, you spend some morale out of your little morale bank. Yeah. And then when you get to the bottom, you have to reset. You take a turn resetting it. But those resets happen a lot.
Yeah.
And so I always feel like I feel like I don't actually have, like, there's not a lot of experimentation with timing. You kind of just do like one or two actions and then you spend a turn not doing an action.
Right.
And I just feel like, but it's really cool stuff that you're doing, these two rondelles, that you're moving around rondelles, and then you're like, do I use this resource to deliver to get cash because I need cash for this or that, or do I go here to improve my abilities? Mm-hmm. So that decision space is really cool, but ultimately the experience that I was hoping to get from it, which was this feeling of like, oh, you move the rondelle. I was just lining myself up to go here, but you just moved that, so you mess up the rondell for me. It doesn't really fire off on those, doesn't have those moments for me.
It's really interesting because I was just thinking about, for, you know, not yesterday, I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking there is something about how much maintenance you have to do in a game. Hmm. And how much of a game are turns in which you get to do something versus turns in which you have to do something.
Yeah.
And that is a game that when you take in your whole turn is resetting your morale so you can do more things. That's maintenance. That's, oh, I got to do that. No one feels excited about, oh boy, I get to do that now. And I think of games like Hallertau, you know, is you have to move that community center along. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the price of admission. It's the tax on the game up to a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be variations in terms of how far you have to move it. But let's be honest, you got to move at a pretty decent amount to be competitive in that game. And so all of your actions are towards something you have to do as opposed to branching out and trying different strategies in terms of what you want to do. I think that's a Crescent City Cargo problem. I think there's a lot of that.
I think I just need a little bit more game testing to sort of just smooth it out in a way to really make it. It's like a really good draft of a game, and yeah. I just wanted it like some tweaks to just tighten it up. Like it's a little too easy to fulfill contracts that you need to fulfill.
Yep.
I never really have too many issues with where the person is on the rondel. It's never too prohibitive for what I need to get done. There were a lot of sequencing things like, oh, I need to go here to get this stuff to apply here. When I do that, I can do this. When I do this, I can do that. So like there's that kind of stuff in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not like, I think sometimes like the Manhattan Project is a game where you have a moment where you're just like, is this the moment that I take my turn to call everyone back or do I push a little bit farther? Right.
Sure.
And I don't think that Crescent City Cargo has a lot of decision space on when to take your reset. You just sort of, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I picked up three pieces of meat from the dock and
I'm done.
Now I got to reset my morale and I'm going to take another piece of meat and now I got to reset. And
yeah, I mean, there are ways that you can drag that on and you can take a little bit longer, but you're getting less value for each action you take when you do that. So, it becomes...
But I do want to dig into it more because sure. I enjoyed my second play more than my first play.
Okay.
But I still have a nagging feeling like this is ultimately a flawed game.
At the end of the day, for me, it reminded me of Shipyard, but I like Shipyard a lot more. That's where I come down on that one. For me, my game on the brain right now, well, I'm definitely thinking about Versailles 1919. I'm still smarting after my horrible showing.
Oh, I heard.
About last time. But we misplayed a rule that would have changed everything. But, you know, what can you do? Well. But really, I'm thinking about Quest. And I don't know if it's a good game.
I was shocked. Because the last time I saw you guys before the parental break, we busted out Quest for the first time and we played it two times in a row. And I thought it was super fun. Like, you know, I like Avalon. It's fine, but it's like not my favorite. And sure. I enjoyed Quest a lot. I thought Quest was so fun. I couldn't believe how much fun I had. And then I kept hearing about you guys were playing Quest. And so when I showed up last night at game night, I was like, all right, let's play some Quest. And you guys were like, and you literally said, are we done with Quest? We're done with Quest, aren't we? And I was like, ah, did I miss the Quest window too?
You missed so much with your 3-week quarantine. No, we're not done with Quest yet. We're not done with Quest yet, but we didn't have Paul, and Paul, it's his copy, and he's the guy who has been setting up the scenarios. So I would have to have done my homework, and I didn't have time on Friday to do my homework to figure out what's the ideal setup for this number of players or this sort of thing. But I will say we have played a lot of games of it, and I would say 10% were successful games.
Well, that's not a great ratio.
Maybe 20%, but that's about it. So the question comes down
to is
what, because there's a game in there.
Yeah.
And it may be, first of all, it may not play well at all the counts where it says it can play. Right, mm-hmm. I don't know if the small player count games will ever work. I don't think they do.
Mm.
For the larger player count games, I think it's going to come down to balancing the roles properly. Mm-hmm. And if you get the right combination of roles, it becomes a game. Right? Yeah. And when it becomes a game, that's fantastic. But it just seems that the way it's delivered in the box is they're maybe promising things that they can't deliver on, or at least we haven't been able to find out how that's supposed to work. And there have been a bunch of people saying that, oh boy, one side almost never wins or never wins.
Mm-hmm.
That's that's bad in this kind of game. That's just a bad situation.
Well, I guess you can then just start looking forward to Blood on the Clock Tower whenever that arrives in 30 years.
I last heard 2031, I think, is they're pretty sure.
Can't wait for that to finally arrive. I mean, there is going to be
Martian dust in every copy.
It's a very involved game to make. I mean, you have to print out some cards, and you know, it's a lot. I don't mean to shade like that, because I know that it's very hard to actually make these games, and especially nowadays with everything going on with
it's the super hard now. But freight. When you do a Kickstarter and you don't deliver for a long period of time, that's bad.
Yeah, I would actually say it's very bad at this point.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. All right, here we go. It's time for our game review. We're doing Mind Management. That is Mind, MGMT, the psychic espionage game. The designers are Jay Cormier and Sen Fung Lim. The artist is Matt Kint, and the publisher is Off the Page Games. Ben, what is Mind Management about?
What is Mind Management? Mind Management is a hidden movement game. It's one person versus the table. It's a game that is based off of a graphic novel of the same name. The graphic novel, did you say who did the graphic novel in your things? Because I
did not.
I was bad. I did not come prepared, but I do have the book right here. Well, I will find the name. I'm sorry to the author of the graphic novel, but I'll come back to that. But it's based off of a graphic novel, and it's about as simple of a pitch of a game as it could be. One person is a quote-unquote recruiter for this shady psychic organization that has been preventing the world from various things, terrible maladies. That's at least what this organization pretends to be. And there's one person who's the recruiter for this organization, and then everyone else at the table are quote-unquote rogue agents who have left the organization and are, according to the rule book, are bad guys, but maybe they're actually the good guys. That's all just flavor text. The truth is, it's just 1v4, and you're moving around this map of Zanzibar, and you are trying to, as a recruiter, you're trying to recruit people to the organization by visiting various, I don't want to say landmarks, they're sort of like features of the map. Like, you might go to an umbrella and you might recruit someone there, or you'll go to a bus and recruit someone there. And the agents are trying to intercept you and capture you before you find all the recruits that you need, or time runs out of the clock. And it's really about as simple as that.
Yeah. And when you get right down to it, all these games kind of owe their allegiance to Scotland Yard to some degree, right?
Yeah. Which I've never played, actually.
Oh, really?
I played Mr. Jack. Which, okay, I know it's very close
different
to it.
No, that's more of a deduction game, strictly.
Okay.
As opposed to hidden move. Well, I guess, yeah, that no, is, I understand what you're saying.
I mean, it's Jack the Ripper, for crying out loud.
It is. But, yeah, so the person that is playing the recruiter is playing Mr. X, if you know your Scotland Yard. And everyone else plays the detectives, essentially what it is. Mind Management, by the way, is a game by Matt Kint, so the same guy who did the art for the game.
I figured when you said the art was Matt Kint.
Yes.
Kint or Kintz?
Kint, K-I-N-D-T.
When you said Matt Kint, I was like, I think that's probably the same guy, because all of the art on the board, everything in the box is all, you know, directly from, not, I don't want to say from the graphic novel, because I'm not well-versed enough with the graphic novel, but it is the artist of that has made all these components.
And it's cool-looking art. It's very, you know, this game, this comic book was put out by Dark Horse, but it's got very kind of outsider indie art style to it.
Yes.
I think Fritz the Cat, kind of, when I look at some of these things and stuff like that, it's cool.
Yeah, I actually think that it really serves this game to talk about this art and presentation first before we dive into it, because it's funny, you don't care that much about components, and I said before, first, the game has to be good. But I will say, that being said, I think the art is fantastic.
100%.
I love it. I've heard some other people say, well, the art is, you know, it's not my cup of tea. I think it's wonderful because it's actually a distinct point of view of an artist.
Yes.
Not that the other art in board games isn't, but this is very much like of a graphic novel. It's a specific POV.
Yeah, and listen, and when I say I don't really care about the presentation, that's only to a point, right? What I mean by that is game first. If the game plays great and the art is horrible, I will still like the game. Mm-hmm. But the best presented game that is a weak game is not going to interest me. That said, when a game is good and the art is good, that is a value add, no question about it. And this game in particular, because the way hidden movement and deduction happens in this game has to do with symbology on the board, mm-hmm. that makes art a crucial element, right?
Yeah, the art is fantastic. And also just the general presentation of the entire game is great. There are all these fun little things on the box. You look closely and there might be a... I'm reaching. I actually brought the box. The art was so important, I brought it to the recording session. There's little things. Like, if you look at the box closely, it looks like someone wrote with their pen, "Don't trust this." You know, like little fun things. Like, this one says, there's one that says, "Seriously," with an arrow.
Which reminds me very much of reviewing The Initiative with Jesse. This game mm-hmm. has some hidden messages and little tricks. And we will talk about whether or not there is a legacy component to this.
Yes,
game.
We are. You know, one thing that comes, so there's a time track on the game, because I said you could run out of time.
Yeah.
And the way you track the time, there's a little token that's like you move up the track. But the token is actually, it's a ring, and inside is like that red cellophane, and it's like the old cereal boxes where you hold that up to your eye and you can read hidden messages. And there's all sorts of hidden messages throughout the rule book and all in the box. And some of those hidden messages, you can go to a website and you can type in words you find out, and then the website will give you something that you can add to the game. Like, there's fun immersive things that, for me, it's not like, oh, this is why the game works, but it adds a lot of fun to this experience. Yeah. And I especially, I just reached over to grab this. I want to give a huge amount of props to the screen, because since this is hidden movement, the recruiter has a big old screen to hide their movements. And first of all, the screen looks amazing.
Gorgeous.
It's like it depicts a city block. And what's cool is, you know the way screens look. You got a center rectangle area, and then you got the flaps. So the city block extends around the flaps. So it actually looks like an actual city block
really
in
does.
Front of you. But also, it's a big enough screen that you can't see over it. That's yep. an issue sometimes.
Sure.
And so we played last night on a little table, and we both were recruiters on different sessions.
Correct.
And both of us hit the table multiple times because it was a little table, and the screen did not fall over.
Did not move.
That is actually a very important thing in a game like this.
It remained resolute.
It passed the screen tests.
So hidden movement goes back to Scotland Yard, as we mentioned, right? Scotland Yard was actually a Parker Brothers release
yes.
way back in the day. Now I think Ravensburger puts it out. But the way that hidden movement works is the person playing Mr. X writes down on a little piece of paper his starting location. And all the locations in London have numbers, right? And you start off in a number. And he is going to use tokens that represent whether or not he's taking a taxi, a bus, or the subway. Right, or the mm-hmm. tube, right? If you use the tube, guess what? You're going a very long distance, but there are very few tubes, so it's kind of...
You're showing...
You can go farther, but it's easier to figure out where you are.
Mm.
The buses are in between, and the taxis go through all these tiny little points and stuff like that, but it's hard to get away with the taxi. And what the investigators will see when you start moving is they will simply see what forms of transportation you're taking. And then every once in a while, at 4 or 5 points in the game, you will have to, as Mr. X, reveal your location and then immediately move on.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the investigators are moving around trying to find a good... trying to get to a good place where they can quickly move anywhere when they need to. Because when Mr. X shows up and, you know, Mr. X was spotted here in location 87, everybody's racing to get there as quickly as possible. And Mr. X is trying to get the hell away from there as quickly as possible in order to get away. It's a very simple system, and it works quite well.
Yes.
This game does a totally different thing. First of all, Mr. X's only goal is to outlast his hunters.
In Scotland Yard, the goal is just to outlast.
Correct. It's just make it long enough that you eventually the hunters can't hunt anymore and can't, right. and can't find you. In this game, that is one of two ways the yes. Mr. X character, in this the case recruiter. The recruiter,
yeah.
can win. The recruiter can win by recruiting 12 people.
So yeah, so we mentioned that briefly, and now let's go a little bit more in depth on how that works. So we have this map, and the map is divided, it's a grid, and the grid is divided, what, 42 squares, we said? Is
correct,
it 6x7?
Yes.
And on every square, of the grid, there are, almost every square, there are two features, okay? There might be a bus and a book, although here's another fun part about the game. The game just has a very fun sense of humor. It's not, you don't just see a book, it's a subversion bookstore, and the bus is a dream bus, and there's things like, you see umbrellas, and those aren't umbrellas, those are thought shield umbrellas, and there's some dogs, and those are not just dogs, those are C4 canine assassination dogs. So everything everything has like this like layer of flavor that's fun. So every square has two features on it, okay? And you have an accompanying, there's a card deck full, and each card represents one of those features. And I think we have, I don't know, it looks like about 12 or 15 features. I didn't count them
Something
up.
Something like that. Let's see, it's five features each. So that would be like 13 or 14?
There's 16 features. I just counted 16, them.
There you go.
Yeah. And so what happens is the recruiter at the beginning of the game, amongst other setup things, the recruiter draws from that deck three random features, and only the recruiter knows what they have. And those features are the places where the recruiter is going to recruit people, right? Because again, you have to recruit in the full game. There's a training game and a full game. In a full game, you have to recruit 16 of these recruits. And
16 or 12, isn't it 12?
12, you're right. 16 features, 12 recruits.
Yes.
So you have to go. You have to go to these places on the board where the features that you pulled from your cards, mm-hmm. where they exist. And every time you encounter a feature, you get a recruit. Okay, so that as the recruiter, you're trying to forge a path that way. But forging a path is not as simple as it sounds,
because you cannot backtrack on your path. Once you have crossed entered a square, you can never enter that square again, which
yeah.
is really, really interesting. So your path has to be planned out in a, you know, to some small or large degree. Not to mention what happens when the other guys, the detectives in this case, the mind management people, start to catch on to where you are. All of a sudden, you have to change your plan. And
yes. You have to rely on some sneakiness, because on your turn as the recruiter, you're only allowed to go one orthogonal space away. There are some minor exceptions. There's like two spots on the map that allow you to do some diagonal movement. But you are just kind of slowly snaking around this map. And
every other move, you have to reveal how many people you've recruited.
Yeah. Every other action you say, okay, between the last time I did a reveal, I have collected this many more recruits.
Yes.
And so what happens is that, you know, you're starting to basically leave a trail as the rogue agents start to piece things together, which we'll explain how they do that in a moment. But as they start to piece things together, they can see, it seems like, you know, it seems like Tom went in this general direction, and these are the icons he passed. And if he gained three since last time, and this thing came up three times, you start to piece together information.
100%. And it is so. What you're doing as the and we should say also say one more thing. One tool you have as the recruiter is you have a single token that allows you to move two spaces instead of one space.
Yeah.
And that is your lifeline. And by the way, in Scotland Yard, you have three double move mm-hmm. actions where you get to move twice instead of once. And that's how you get away from trouble when it comes up. The interesting thing, though, is what we're doing as the investigators is we always can move, and the investigators can move two spaces orthogonally.
Yep.
And then they can take one action. And that action is a variety of things. For instance, you can do an ask action where you are going to say, hey, I am on the location. I'm on those canine, the C4 assassination dogs
yeah.
space. I'm going to ask you, would you show us one place that you walked that had canine assassination dogs?
And then if I've been on a spot that has an assassination dog, there's these little footstep tokens, and I have to put a footstep on one of those. If I haven't been to one, I can say I haven't been to one. Either way, you're going to get information. And the rogue agents have these little thought bubbles. They're like little dry erase thought bubbles. And there's 15 of them, and only 15. And you have those to sort of use to mark down, like, oh, between turns 1 and 4, they were probably here or not. So when you ask, you're going to get information about these various features and where things were. And as these bubbles go down, and potentially as these footsteps go down, it starts to paint a picture.
Yeah.
And then as a rogue agent, if you go to a spot that has a footstep, instead of doing an ask action, what you can do is a reveal action where you basically are going to force the recruiter to reveal the timestamp of when they were there. And by the way, that when we say timestamp, it's basically like the turn. So like turn number...
Yeah. It's basically the first space on the board is 1 to 5 o'clock, yeah, which means the first 5 moves of the recruiter.
Yeah.
Right? Then the next space is 6 o'clock, then 7, then 8. And it just means the 6th turn, 7th turn, 8th exactly. turn, so on and so forth. So when we, in our game, finally remembered that we could pin down when you were in a certain place, Ben.
Yes, yes.
And we picked the right one, and you said, oh, I was there at 10 o'clock. And we realized, oh, it's 1,400 hours, which means we're only 4 spaces away. He couldn't have gone that way. He couldn't have gone that way. That means yes. he had to go this way. And boy, oh boy, your goose was cooked.
Yeah, so basically, we were playing a game. It was Tom and Mike. And I decided I was not going to do the recruiting strategy because I didn't want to give them that much information of, you know, because, you know, when you recruit thing, the more you recruit, the more you're sort of showing like what features there could have been, because I already had a bunch of footsteps out. So I was just kind of eluding them, and they had forgotten. I had confused them completely with my path, and they had forgotten about this reveal feature. So they had read my path in reverse. They thought that the beginning was the end and the end was the beginning. So they were sort of looking in a different area. And then finally Tom was like, oh, I should look at this. And I was like, oh shoot. And it's going to be a high number, which means it was a recent number. And, I was caught.
But there, soon well, after. We had other good deductions, which is one of the things is once you start to see a path laid out, once those footsteps go down, you start to realize, oh, okay, so he was on these 3 or 4 spaces mm-hmm. during rounds 1 through 6. I look and I see, oh, during rounds 1 through 6, he recruited 3 people.
Yes.
I can look at the symbols that are in that area, and I can start to deduce, okay, it's unlikely that he recruited at a book because there were no books there, right? It's very likely that he recruited at one of the buses because there are 2 buses and we needed that to think. So we start
Dream to bus, if you will.
The dream bus, beg your pardon. And once we start to figure out what his 3 cards are, what the 3 symbols he is most looking for, oh boy, can you do some stuff. I don't think we can explain everything about the immortals or any of that sort of stuff, but
it's another device that helps you and does stuff.
So suffice it to say, there are these other pieces that just sort of hang out on the board, and the recruiter can move them 1 space, a turn. The recruiter can use them to gain extra recruits.
At the expense of giving up more information. Correct.
But the other guys, the rogue agents, they can hit those Shut guys up and say, I believe that one of your recruiting symbols is the bus. And then you, if you have the bus, have to get rid of that card. And now you can only recruit on 2 symbols, not 3 symbols anymore.
There's like a whole layer in the full game of things like the rogue agents have special powers. You play with the immortals in the training game. You don't play with immortals. There's a second mind slip token that's accessible. There's a lot of stuff that sort of takes it to the next level. And I think the game does really in a really cool way is that when it starts, when you are a rogue agent, you think, how the hell am I going to find anything anywhere? Right. And it's one of those games where it feels like, okay, one side has a huge advantage. And then it's you know, it does paint a picture. You can actually use powers of deduction effectively to get into it. And so on that level, I think it worked really, really well. I actually have very few negatives about the game, I have to say.
Let's start with the negatives then.
Yes. Right?
Negative number one, in most of these games, when it says it plays up to five players, that is true, but that's not entirely true. Certainly the person playing the recruiter, the person who's doing the hidden movement, you're always going to have an interesting game. You feel the tension when they're closing in, when they're starting to talk amongst each other, and they're making a lot of sense, and they're you know, and if people just listen to Trey, oh my goodness, they're going to figure out where I am right now, and my goose is cooked. And
yes,
I just hope that they don't. So that's always going to be good. But for the other players, the players playing the rogue agents that are trying to deduce where they are, traditionally in most of these games, it's not exactly like five player, like four investigators have as good a time as two investigators do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I mean it's interesting, right? Because these games are always interesting with player counts, because I think these games actually scale well with player counts. But what's interesting is if you were to do like a one-on-one session,
yeah,
then if one person is controlling all four of those rogue agents, then they just can keep all their thoughts themselves. And then I, as the recruiter, don't get an insight on what they may be doing next. Whereas if you have just one more person,
correct,
you guys, you know, talking amongst yourselves, you guys, I can hear what you guys are planning.
Yes.
But that being said, when you have more people, you also get more ideas and you don't get tunnel vision. So it is also an advantage to you, it's an advantage to me. And so I think when you have, we didn't get to play this with a full five people.
Yeah.
And I actually think, you know, that could be really, really fun, because I think it could be chaotic in a way that'd be really amusing.
Having played these with five, you can do it and it's fine. It's just not quite the additive experience you want it to be, because what you're doing is waiting four turns before it's your turn to move. Now,
yeah,
you're not just waiting, because you're opining and you're debating, sort of like, and people are talking. Now, it does fall prey sometimes to the alpha player syndrome.
I was about to say quarterbacking. And you know what? One thing that is tricky. So Mike was awesome. Like, we met Mike last night. I hadn't met Mike. Yeah. I don't know if you'd met him before. But you know, one thing that is tricky in these sort of games is, like, right in the first game, you were the recruiter and Mike and I were working together. When you don't really know someone, it's a different dynamic than when you know someone and you can be like, you know, you can really sort of just like, I think there's a lot of fun when you have like a friend that you really know and you can kind of like, it's not like you fight,
sure,
but you can sort of like express your intentions or what you want a little bit more honestly than when there's someone you don't know. You are like, well, I don't want to be obnoxious. I want to be receptive. I want to get, you know, like,
right.
And this is, and please don't misinterpret this. This has nothing to do with Mike. Mike was great. It's just it's the state of a dynamic of,
sure,
anyone, anytime you play with someone new. So when you play, I think, a hidden movement game with someone that you've literally just met, there's also a different dynamic that goes into it that you should be aware of if you are playing a game like this.
Do you think when you were the recruiter, do you think there was any alpha player stuff going on our side?
No, I didn't think that at all.
I didn't think that way with you and him as well. I thought that there was a
very
really
respectful,
good, yeah, a sharing of ideas, and I'm not really sure, you know, go with your gut on this one. I'll support you in your decision, and I think that's a really good way to do it.
Well, actually, Mike was very funny, because he, when I was the recruiter, so I had done this path, this vertical path, and I think all that had been revealed were like two footsteps, and he automatically was like, well, that's number six and that's number five. And he's like, and he obviously came down this way and this is what it was. And it was literally based off of nothing. But as it happened, he was 100% correct.
Right.
And I was infuriated, because I was like, I wanted to be like, you're basing this off of nothing and you're totally right. Damn it. But I don't know how he was able to divine that. And it was very, very stressful for me.
So second negative for me is the fiddliness of the legacy stuff might become a problem.
We haven't talked about that, actually.
Let's talk about that real quick. Simply to say that when you complete missions, you can, there are little packets to open, and they add new roles or new weapons or new additions that change the game in subtle ways. And I like that in theory, because I like, you know, game extension, yes, obviously, right?
You know, it didn't really bother me too much in this case. You know, I'm not a big legacy person. And let me just say that the way it works in this game is, I think the designer sort of envisioned that the same group of people play the game sort of like a few sessions in a night, maybe. Sure. And so, like, if the recruiter wins, then the rogue agents get to open up a packet that's going to advantage them, and then vice versa. So each side is going to sort of like level up a little bit.
Self-balancing.
Yeah. Which I think is actually a cool idea. It's called they call it the shift system, trademarked. And it's legacy-esque in that when you open up those packets, there are certain things that then stay in the game going forward, and other things you can just pack up, and you can decide with every new game session if you want to include them or not. So it's legacy-esque, and it's esque enough that I actually don't mind it, because I'm not like totally sold on legacy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times I feel like legacy games, in an effort to create a narrative experience, mm-hmm. cram in so much junk that it gets in the way of the game. And I found like this was relatively unobtrusive.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think it was.
But I understand. It is a little fiddly.
It's a little fiddly. It's not the easiest teach, I will say that too.
Yeah. Well, we also jumped into the full game. We just were like, let's go right into the full game. I actually do think starting with a training game would have been a little bit easier, because for some reason, when you're just starting with like the Immortals, there is like a layer of, it's like, this is the stickiness I was talking about before.
Sure, sure.
There's like a layer of rules that are not hard, but for some reason, I had a little bit of stickiness issues in the beginning with it. It isn't the easiest teach, but it's not really a hard game at all. I mean, as a rogue agent, you're doing three things. As a recruiter, you're just like walking around.
Yeah.
But it just, it was a little bumpy out of the gate for us.
But at the end of the day, it is a hidden movement game that plays with a slightly different mechanism than I've seen in any other hidden movement game. And it's a mechanism that seems to work quite well. There was good. Like, we had one recruiter victory and we had one rogue agent victory. So we saw a little bit of both sides of it. And it felt tense and tight in both cases.
Yes. I felt, so when I was the recruiter, I went for the hide and seek strategy, which I felt, for me, that was very tense, because it's a long time you've got to hide out. And so,
yes.
And you guys were closing in on me, and then I was able to confuse you guys, and you guys went to a whole other side of the board. And like we said before, I was about to get away with it until you finally got, you picked up my scent. I did feel like there was tension on both sides. And as we played it, I started to see layers of strategy that weren't initially apparent to me.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of how you create your path, you think your path, you're just going to try to go for as many recruiting spots as possible, but there's layers in terms of the icons you visit.
Yeah.
And then also how you use the Immortals, where you place the Immortals will impact what clues the rogue agents can ask about. And so there were layers of strategy that started to present themselves to me, which I really liked. I will say my only significant negative, it's not significant. It's literally a quibble. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that really jumped out at me was about those Immortals. The Immortals are like the same shape as the rogue agents.
Yes, they look, it's difficult to determine which is which, that's for sure.
And you need to know which is which, because like I said, where the Immortals are, they sort of like lock down certain features that can be asked about. And so when you're trying to figure out where are the Immortals and what is being locked down, it's like, it takes too many beats to figure that out. 100%. It sort of becomes an annoyance. It sort of crosses over from into annoyance. And I wished that the Immortals were like some crazy shape or a square versus a circle or something like that. And I wish it was easier to block off on the board which features are not askable.
That's my last negative. My last negative is that the game says specifically that you can only use the components given to you. So you can't take notes, right? In all of these other deduction games, you can take notes to try and figure out what's going on. And this one specifically says you can't. And I'm not sure about that. I don't know. Maybe the balance of the game is such that if you do take notes, it's too hard.
Or too easy. Yeah, too easy for the rogue agents.
Yeah, and too hard for the recruiter.
I'm okay with only having those 15 things, but I do think there should be some components to block up. There's a list of the features, and it just makes it easier when you're like, which ones can I ask about? Rather than having to look under every immortal, and considering that every immortal looks like every rogue agent, that's like an annoyance, but it does not get in the way of the game. The game is really fun.
Yeah. If you're looking for a, you know, just sort of a new wrinkle on deduction games or hidden movement games, I think mind management is definitely something you should check out, right?
Yeah.
Not be for absolutely everybody, but it's really good.
It was like a, you know, it was just like a solid, like right down the, like, I don't know what the metaphor is, but it's just like a good game. Is this like a 10? Is this one that is like the best game of all time? No, but I think this is a really fun hidden movement game. Yeah. It was, you know, our second game was longer because since I was doing the hide and seek, that caused a longer game. There was more thought, but I think probably a typical game would be like an hour 15 minutes.
Yeah. I think that's about right, which is a good length for a deduction game as well.
Yeah, and it's something I'm looking forward to diving into it more and peeling back more of those layers. And I think that actually when you do play with the same people, people are going to start developing a meta that'll be really fun. And there are lots of like interesting wrinkles in this game, and it's also fun to look at this board and at this like this city that you're navigating through. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Ditto. Same here. Yeah, it's a recommend.
It's weird. It's almost like there's not much to say about it because it's just good.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm not saying good, like it's, I'm not saying it's just good. I'm saying it works. It works. There's almost, there's not much to say about it. I think these features around the board are really clever and they're interesting and they're whimsical and it's fun. The art is great. Yeah. Very happy with it.
100%. 100%. That was mind management. Moving on, we're going to talk about uncommon game mechanisms. So deduction games, not exactly a common mechanism, right? A very small subset of games are deduction games. Very small subset of games are hidden movement games, right? You've got Scotland Yard, as we said, mind management. You've got Fury of Dracula. You've got Letters from Whitechapel. You've got Captain Sonar. I can't keep going and naming too many. There's certainly more. There's some war games that have hidden movement.
I think Tragedy
Flat
Looper
Top and all that. Sorry, Tragedy Looper. Yeah.
Tragedy Looper is hidden movement esque.
Yeah, but in comparison to Area Control or Hand Management or Worker Placement, I mean these are niche components or niche mechanisms. So what Ben and I are going to do is we're going to talk about some of our favorite mechanisms that you just don't see too often, and then we'll end up with our top five, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited. Let's dive into this. I know, Trey, you better get ready. There's going to be some annotations here. I know. he's already furious at us.
All right. So what's the first one you want to talk about?
Are we in our top five or just
No. Right now we're doing our honorable mentions and then we'll get to the
One thing that is not used a lot is drawing.
Yes.
Drawing games, and there are obviously in party games. I mentioned Fagar's Ghost of New York, but Roads and Boats.
Telestrations. Oh.
Roads and Boats, you actually draw roads on the map. There's a plexiglass over the map, and you draw your little routes.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. In Captain Sonar, you have to accurately trace something, and it's a speed thing to some degree. That's another game that has some drawing in it. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels weird. It feels weird to be drawing on your games, but...
Welcome to, I believe. I think a lot of
the Rolling Rights. I exclude the Rolling Rights because they're like inherent.
It's a different thing. Yeah.
You know, you inherently scribble and draw on those. You know,
100%. For me, budgeting. One of the reasons I love Crystal Palace so much is that it is one of the only games I know that has budgeting. You have six dice, and you do not roll those dice to be able to choose your actions. You choose each and every die and what you want that die to be. So for your round, you have this. It's budgeting. You are literally deciding how much you want to spend in order to have a superpowered turn or a really underpowered turn. And I wish more games would play with that, because the amount of control, the amount of hard decisions that you have to make, the amount of planning you have to make, and the amount of sacrifices. It's like, I can have a monster turn, but how many actions am I going to have to take after that just to get my money up to the point where I could do that kind of thing again? Finding that the answers within budgeting, to me, I know you say budgeting and you're like, yeah, pass.
I mean,
but it's really fascinating.
I mean, there's so many things in board games that in real life I detest, right? But in board games are like the best. Like budgeting, like, wow, God, wasn't it so fun? I played a game last night where I had to budget every single thing out, and then I go home, I'm like, I don't want to look at my bank. But I actually think that there's budgeting in a large number of games, but maybe what you're saying is like a budget forward game.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, well, Age of Steam, whenever you play Age of Steam, you're budgeting.
You're always budgeting resources and stuff, but it's not
budgeting forward. That's exactly right.
Budget forward.
Yes.
Fruit
forward.
Here's one that I don't see very often. Teams. So I don't see it often enough that I had a hard time even coming up with the example. You mentioned Captain Sonar. I thought of a game that I actually did not like at all, but Cerebria was a team game.
Yep.
But you don't see teams that often, and that would actually be, you know, I think that would actually be pretty cool to see more team stuff. You see it in party games, but, you know, beyond that.
Sure, yeah. You're going to play Friedrich tomorrow. In some ways...
I guess
one against many...
Yeah, but right? I could say those are like cousins, or close cousins, kissing cousins.
Yeah, because it's not really a team game because each person's going for their own individual victory. But if three do not work against the one, Friedrich's going to win. So
yeah.
Those imbalances, I think, are very interesting.
Yes.
Well, guess what? I have something very, very similar to that.
What's that?
Alliances.
Ooh.
And the forming of alliances. So in the game of Dune, it's every man for himself, it's every player for themselves, until you hit a nexus, right? A worm event where suddenly people, all of a sudden it becomes a negotiation game. It wasn't a negotiation game, and now it is. It's like, dude, you and I form up. We already have three of these. We just need to get one more. And then somebody else is like, yeah, but when you form up, you get to use my power a little bit. And guess what? He may have the real estate, but his power is nonsense. It's barely anything good for you. You need what I have.
I know the perfect game for that. That is like just, it does it so well.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight Imperium, have you heard of it? You may have known. It's a great game.
Yeah, we're going to have to edit this because you said it does it well. That's what you said.
I am here to be the voice of reason on this podcast and say that.
No, you're not. You're not. By the way, Mike who came the other night when we mentioned TI4, he was like, oh, that's not a good game. I said, I love you, Mike. You're welcome anytime.
I am happy that you found a kindred soul. So
there are so many of us. There are so many more of us than there are of you. But let's say one more game that is a forming alliance game. Struggle of Empires, a Martin Wallace classic going back. It's probably the most interesting thing about this. This is a game, heavy strategy game set during the Age of Exploration and all that sort of stuff. And you are playing one of the world powers at the time. And each round, you are bidding. You are putting up for bid somebody to be in Alliance A and somebody to be in Alliance B. And you keep on doing that until and it can play up to seven players. All the players are in one alliance or another. And the interesting thing about it is that if you are in alliance with people, you cannot attack them. You cannot take their land. You cannot take their anything. You could only attack the people in the other alliance. So the amount of effort and pain that goes through forcing the person that you are most vulnerable to into an alliance with you so that you can't be attacked by them is just, fantastic.
That sounds very fun. There was a game that I wanted to play that I never got to play called Dogs of War that seemed to be all about alliances shifting alliances. And again, there's alliances. You could make an argument that every game potentially could have an alliance, but these are games that are really about alliances and creating alliances and have them like alliances in the rules like that.
Totally.
In a different direction, building things, like having a three-dimensionality in the game. So like I think of Ginkopolis, you're putting tiles on top, you're actually building vertically. Expansity is a city building game where you're actually like creating little skyscrapers.
Right.
I think of Lords of Vegas with the up expansion, because Lords of Vegas, you are building laterally, but with the expansion, you also build vertically. Teotihuacan is probably one of the bigger ones recently that had a three-dimensional thing where the actual height mattered. It's just kind of fun. It's kind of fun to have to add height to the board game.
It makes the estates work really well, right?
I mean, the estates is a great one.
Right. I also think that they're
Gunkimono.
Sure, there are older games. The Climbers is an interesting game that is all about
Played that, but yeah.
All about verticality. And there's an older game called Pueblo, which is a really interesting game where you have this 3D thing in the middle and there are blocks and you're removing blocks and things like that. And the game mechanism is what colors can you see from the various faces as you're making your choices.
Yeah, I actually have a dexterity game. Was dexterity on your list? If it is, I will.
No, it is not.
Oh, but I have a dexterity game. It really is more dexterity forward, but it's sort of in the Jenga style of you build a tower and try not to knock it over. But it's called Minara, and it's like crazy Jenga, where like all the pieces are these. You have these pillars and these crazy pieces of cardboard that make crazy shapes, and so everything balances in strange ways.
Sure.
And yes, it's really about dexterity in that game. But again, the idea that you build this big tower that's so funky looking is just, it's such a blast.
Yeah, I mean, Meeple Circus is another dexterity game that involves verticality and using odd pieces in odd ways. Mega City Oceana, I think, is
right. That one, I remember you guys talking about that.
Yeah, that's another one that's like that.
And actually, there's a new game that just came out called Embarcadero that I think has stacking. I think it's from Renegade Games, where it's like you stack onto boats.
Huh.
It's cool. I like it.
For me, games where you get to choose your starting conditions.
Mm.
One of my favorite things in the world. So in D-Mocker, my favorite game of all time. No, let me correct that. The best game of all time, D-Mocker.
Yes. Better than Twilight Imperium?
boy.
Don't worry. Twilight Imperium is not my favorite game, so I will allow it.
In D-Mocker, you have to choose. You have like a menu at a Chinese restaurant where you have to select one choice from column A and one choice from column B, and it's literally saying, "I want to start with campaign workers in these two or three regions, and this many media influences out on the board, or I'm going to start with this many party members, right? So this many delegates." In my party, and this, right? And you're literally choosing your starting conditions.
Yes.
And you all do it secretly, and then everybody reveals, and you sort of pepper the board with what you start with. Really, really interesting dynamic. I will say the other game that is amazing in that regard is the expansion to Lorenzo.
I was going to say it. We just had a meet cute, a brain meet cute.
It is so good. It is such an incredible mechanism.
What? Yeah,
you are bidding for player order, and what you're bidding is how many things you get at the start, and you're literally bidding downwards to. It's name that tune. I can be start player with three. Resources.
It's a great system. I'm actually surprised we are not seeing that more since that game. It was a really great idea.
I mean, I think that's kind of what this segment is. It's like, hey, these are amazing things that are seen fairly rarely. Yeah. We should see more of them.
Well, I've got one that's on the other end of that. So you talked about variable star powers. What about or starting position or whatever? What about what Great Zimbabwe does, which is a variable ending? End game trigger, which is that Great Zimbabwe is that everyone at the beginning of the game has to basically reach like 20 points or something, or 30 or
30,
whatever.
I think
it's 20. 20 points.
Okay, because right.
But as you invest in things that will give you asymmetric powers, make you more powerful in the game.
The gods, you get a god that is yours.
You can do it to the gods, but there can be other craftsmen, things like that. As you basically invest in things that make your game better, the threshold you need to reach to win the game goes up. So everyone is going for a different victory point, like end game. It's a race game, but all our finish lines start to separate out, which is such a cool idea. So it's kind of the perfect counterpoint to the, like, we're going to start with different abilities.
I'm taking the Trickster God. The Trickster God gives me this game, literally game-breaking power. It is so much better than the base game thing. The only problem is now I need 35 victory points to win the game.
Yeah.
So the question is does the advantage that I get for this god that literally makes me way better than everybody else, is that, am I going to get to my 35 faster than other people will crawl to their 20 points?
That is amazing. So such a fun thing that I've literally never seen anywhere else.
100%. 100%. Next thing for me is a selection track. We are only seen it a few times. Lignum is the example that I use all the time. Francis Drake and Paris most recently has this in it as an element. The idea being that you are getting the resources necessary for the second part of the game, round, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And you move along a track. And you can move slowly along that track or fast along that track. The caveat is you can never move backwards. So anything you skip over, you are saying, I am not taking that.
Yes.
So there are the tortoise and there are the hares in this model. And the decision space for that is delicious. The hares are saying, oh, that thing that is eight spaces ahead on the track is the thing I need most of all. I'm going to skip all of that stuff, and I'm going to make sure that I get that. And the tortoise is like, okay, I'll take one crew here, and I'll take cannons here, and I'll take one thing here.
Yep.
And always, there's also an end condition as well. So the last person to reach the end of that track has a significant disadvantage in the next phase. It's phenomenal. It's such a good
one of my all-time favorites. I'm actually surprised I didn't put that. I thought about it briefly, and I don't know. That probably would actually be a top five for me. I think that is so fun. And you have different variations of it. So you have like the Glenmore or the Kraftwagen one where like whoever's in the back of that will just get to take turns until they're not in the back. But I think actually one of my all-time favorite versions of that is from Heaven and Ale. Because Heaven and Ale, I think Heaven and Ale is an excellent game, and it's ever so slightly undervalued, I think.
It's a sleeper. It is a
sleeper. It is actually an excellent, excellent game, and that track is kind of like, the turn order just goes around. Whether you're in the back or not, turn order just goes. So, it creates this amazing tension because you shoot up ahead, and then you're doing the hare strategy, and then the tortoise can just pick everything up. But then the tortoise doesn't have like free range just to pick everything up because the hare can just keep on haring away. And the tortoise at some point will say, this tortoise lifestyle is great, picking up all these little things. But the truth is, all the really good stuff I'm going to miss out on because I'm going too slowly. So it's, Heaven and Ale, if you haven't played that game, I can't recommend that one highly enough.
Awesome. Awesome.
How about this one? How about this one? Gosh, there's so many good ones. How about this one?
One more and then we do our top
five.
I
could tell this is my last one. I already got the sense. This is my last one I can do. I was going to say deduction, but I'm not going to say deduction. I'm going to say hidden action selection. So
That is in, and by that, do we mean simultaneous action selection?
It could be. Is it in your list? Because if so,
it is.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll say deduction.
There you go.
Deduction. I don't even have to go into this that much because we already talked about Tragedy Looper. We've talked about it already with Mind Management. Decrypto, Letter Jam. I love when the game gives you like clues that you are like, how in the world am I ever going to put this together? And that use of deduction is so great. I wish I liked Alchemists more because that one has an absolutely fantastic deduction element in it. I just think the game around it is really annoying. But I love deduction in games. I wish there was more deduction in games.
100%. All right. My number five uncommon game mechanism is real time. Now this is love it or hate it, right? But Captain Sonar, Galaxy Trucker, Ricochet. How many times do I talk about Ricochet Robots? All the time, right?
Ricochet Robots is really fun. I learned it from Jesse, who learned it from you.
Yeah, it is a blast. There is something about trying to really solve something in real time and racing against the clock and against other people that is just, everything you, you know, for some people, it is torture and it's horrible. But for other people, it is literally an adrenaline rush that is a fantastic thing in certain game environments.
Yeah, I haven't played it in years, but I really enjoyed Escape the Temple of whatever another.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was really fun. And then I recently purchased a real-time game, as I mentioned in the podcast, Rail Pass, which is a totally silly game, but it's really fun. It's a really, really fun game. And I played that recently, in fact, and had some of the biggest belly laughs that I've had in like a year because of the chaos that it created. So I think that real time games are really fun, and there's a way in where they work really well.
Absolutely. What's your number five?
Well, I didn't really rank these in order, so I'm just going to pull one at random from here. How about Mancala mechanisms? We don't really see enough of those. I think Trajan famously had its Mancala.
Sure, sure.
And
Well, I would say that the power pools in Terra Mystica are
yeah, they're Mancala-esque, yeah, but like but you don't like with Trajan, you like pick up stuff and you distribute. You like there's the correct constant redistribution in that way that was really cool, and I only saw it in one other game called Crusaders Thy Will Be Done, which was like a neat game.
Seth Jaffe.
Yeah, yeah. Neat game. But it's a cool thing. Like, we should see more of that.
100%. My number four is shifting boards.
Oh, you love Docmas. I know you're going to say Docmas.
Of course I'm going to say Docmas. I'm going to say Docmas, but I'm also going to say Wiz War. Oh. These are games. So lots of games have modular boards, right?
Yes.
Modular boards make games eminently replayable because they form and fashion in different ways. Why aren't there more games that allow that modularity to be used to create strategic advantages or disadvantages for players? Mm-hmm. When you can rotate and shift sectors of a board. Docmas is a abstract strategy game, no question about it, and it's all about being able to see what is possible with this board that would not otherwise be evident. And Wiz War is as beer and pretzels, a stab your friend game as you can get, but also has things where all of a sudden this door doesn't go to this next room. It goes to something on the other side of the thing, or you're rotating sectors and suddenly you've put the distance between your enemy and their home like impossibly far away.
Yeah, I think of an old game that I only played for the first time a few years ago, but it was actually really fun. Labyrinth, was it called?
Yes,
Labyrinth?
Yes.
Where you're trying to get around. That was like a really cool use of it. I feel like there's another game that I have or that I really like where you rotate things and a route is changed or whatever. I just can't think of it, but I agree. It's fun when these games sort of like, take a different look at the components that we just take for granted. Like, oh, this is what the board is.
Right.
And a game says, no, the board is in flux. Like, that's cool. That's like a cool use of an actual medium, you know?
100%.
I am going to go with, let's see this one. Here's one that I really, really enjoy that I've literally can only think of one example of. I'm sure there's maybe a few others. I love in the game Lancaster, at the end of every round, there's a moment when the table votes on like a law, right? So we do like a whole worker placement round, and then the table votes on passing laws. And I haven't played the game in a while. I don't remember if the laws are end game scoring or they're like they create a bonus for the next round. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like you're playing a game and then everyone stops and says, okay, this is the state of our game. How do we want to reward ourselves for it? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like really cool that like it's not just a worker placement game, but that there's this element of gathering influence because at the end of the round, we're all going to vote on stuff, on how the game is going to unfold. I think that was really cool and almost ahead of its time.
Warrior Knights does it as well. Yeah, those things where you can create laws and rules that affect one person more than another and change the state of the game, and you can vote on it, I think is amazing when it can work.
Yeah.
Mostly an old school design, right?
Yeah, and also Lancaster has a extra credit because it also features bumping in worker placement, which I think is a really cool thing. I think it's cool when you can... I think bumping people out, and especially if you get some sort of benefit from that, is like also a really cool feature.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
My number three is simultaneous action selection.
Mm-hmm.
This is hidden action selection. In the case of Maharaja, for instance, which is just coming out again.
Yes.
You have a wheel, and on that wheel, there are not one, but two hands on the wheel. And you set them each to a different one of the eight actions that you can take. You put it down. Everybody flips it up, and you are deciding what you're taking. Race for the Galaxy. There are five main actions that you can mm-hmm. take. You're flipping up a card showing which action you are doing. All the actions that everyone selects are going to be done. You get an advantage if you were the one that selected that action. But predicting what other people might or might not take is a really key aspect to that design. And Wallenstein, right? Wallenstein,
okay. I never played that.
Or Shogun is the other version of it.
Okay.
You are taking your territory cards and blanks and putting them down on the 10 actions of the round. And when you flip them up, if it's a blank, you don't take that action. If it's a territory, that's the territory in which that action happens. So looking at the map, looking at the board, looking at other people's situations and trying to predict which action they're going to take in which location is absolutely killer.
Yeah. You see it in Dungeon Lords too. Dungeon Lords is so unforgiving because if you get muscled out of a situation because of that, it's like, well, enjoy. But there's a game called Wings for the Baron. Wings for the Baron. It's a game where you're building airplanes for Germany in World War One.
Really?
It's this random game that I got, but it's simultaneous action selection and tech tree. That's like pretty much the whole game. It's a bizarre game. I'm going to introduce it to you because it's an obscure game. I don't know why I even have it, but
I've never
it's
even
fun.
Heard of it.
It's fun. It was from Victory Point Games, you know.
Sure,
so
sure.
They're kind of like more. I think they're closed now, unfortunately. But for me, it's not only just the simultaneous aspect of it. You actually see it in Tragedy Looper too. Tragedy Looper is like the catch-all game today. But I love sort of like hidden action selection the most in Forbidden Stars because which unfortunately is like not available to anyone at this moment. But
is it unfortunate?
You are trying me, sir. No, it is. It's cool because you get this in Tragedy Looper too, where everyone's going to place stuff. It sounds like also in Shogun. Everyone's going to place things in areas that they want to do things, but no one knows what anyone's actually intending to do in those areas. And so there's a huge amount of like mind games trying to imagine, okay,
double bluffing and so
when they're going to do it. And there's a whole sequencing thing that happens in Forbidden Stars that I find to be like addictive. It's just absolutely amazing.
Totally. Okay. What is your number three?
Okay. My number three. How about this one? How about, I don't know what to call it, so I called it card hijinks. So when I say card hijinks, you know, in some games, you just play a card, right? And whatever's on the card, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I like it when the card itself matters. And what I mean by that is you see in Underwater Cities, if it's an orange card and you play in the orange area, something important is going to happen.
Right.
Or if you play Gugong, like if the value of the card is going to, like in relation to another card that's already there, it's right. going to matter. And you also see that in Zhangguo, where, you know, if you play a card that's higher than something or lower, different things are going to happen. So it's not just that the card itself, not just the power of the card that's mm-hmm. happening, but there's also like another layer, and this is different from like multi-use cards. This is saying like you're not just playing a card. It's how you play the card is going to really impact the gameplay.
Would you put Glory to Rome in that category? Because you can, using the card for the action is then going to put the card out into the central pool where you can grab it later and use it as a resource. And
I think it falls a little bit more under multi-use cards, which I love, but I just don't think that they're underrepresented as a feature.
I love it. My number two is telepathy and prediction.
Oh,
so this is party games. This is the mind
management, if you will.
Well, it's kind of, yeah, but this is the mind. This is wavelength.
Yes.
These are Mysterium. is kind of that way. These are games where the mechanism of the game is trying to get you in sync with somebody else's mind and to be able to think the way they think. That literally is the object of the game. To win the game, the person that wins the game is the person that thinks the most like the other person. So in the case of the mind, it is getting a sense for the timing and values of the cards that they have. In the case of wavelength, wavelength is really interesting because am I trying to think of what you think about this dichotomy, or am I trying to think what you think what I think about about that dichotomy?
And again, this is like a telepathy forward genre, right? Because to a certain extent, you have to always be trying to get into people's heads in a really good game. But it would be cool if there was that telepathy forward aspect in more Euro games, right? What we see in Wavelength, if someone could find a way to weave that into an actual like Euro game, would be crazy.
I totally agree. Totally agree. What's your number two?
My number two, I'm going to say Meeples with Meaning. So, Meeples
the
with...
The Village?
Well, it's funny that you say that. The answer is no to that. You will see why it's funny that you say that. So, Meeples with Meaning, meaning that like when you use this meeple, like this is sort of similar to the card thing. It's not just a meeple. Like the color of the meeple actually matters. It's almost like a second layer of utility to these things. So you see that in Railroad Revolution, where if you use, you know, you always need meeples to do certain actions, but if you use a purple meeple, you get a bonus action, right?
Yeah.
You see that actually in Manhattan Project. They're not meeples, but they're basically meeples. They're little cardboard things. Like you can do this action, but if you do it with a scientist, you're going to get a benefit. So you're thinking about like not just like how I manage these meeples,
right.
but they have like another layer to them, you know. Nippon also is interesting. Nippon, because the color of the meeple is going to impact your budgeting and end of the round. So it's like, it's not just that you take some games just meeples are different colors and that's just it, or maybe it represents like what meeples are your own. But now it's like when it adds another layer of decision making, I think it's really cool.
100%. And my number one choice for uncommon game mechanism is bluffing. I love bluffing and I do not see it enough in games. So simple games like Skull, all about bluffing, right? Mm-hmm. Skull or Skulls and Roses is you have four discs. One of them is the deadly skull. The other three are roses. And you are putting them down and you are trying to, if you bid, I bid four. That means I turn over mine first and then three others, and I have to not hit a skull. If I don't hit a skull, I gain a victory point, two victory points, and you win the whole game. That's basically all the game is. When I play that with my family, and realize Paul is my family.
Yes.
So it is Paul and me and my kids and my wife and his wife and grandma and all that stuff. It is so brutal because we never let the bid go too low. The bid is always too high. Everybody starts to do what we do, which is put skull, 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 rose. And it is just invariably, it gets to the point where people are like, all right, I've flipped over mine and I know mom's is good, so flip over hers. And then look around and like, hey, you should pick mine. You really should pick. You should pick mine. And half the time when I'm saying that, it's because I actually do have a rose down. But people are like, no, I'm not picking you. And the bluffing for that. But also games like Kremlin has tons of bluffing because I don't want to reveal how much influence I have. And really, to win that game sometimes is letting somebody think that they're winning the game when really they're just playing your own puppet.
Yeah.
To the point. And then last but not least, Taj Mahal. Taj Mahal, one of my favorite Reiner Knizia design, probably. It's an amazing, amazing game in which I am playing cards in order to win the five awards, the five valuable things that come out of each and every round of the game. And there are ways to play that game in which you can push people off of strong hands by making it seem like I can go all day. I can keep spending you into the dirt. and getting people to flinch or to back off when you really have already played your last card and you could be dead.
Yeah, I mean, you can make an argument that like almost any auction game could also be considered a bluffing game, but like there's certain right, because I mean there is a certain amount of bluffing in auctioning, right? But I think what you're saying is where it's like it's not, it's just like the real centerpiece is really is about the lack of knowledge about what anyone has and
yeah, well there is a limited knowledge. It's not no knowledge, but there's limited knowledge, and the game is trying to suss out the strength of your opponents at any given moment, and being able to bluff that is a central part.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love
it. That's fun. It's nerve-wracking. But it's fun.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most player interactive things that you can do in a game.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
My last one, I originally was going to call it Meeple Death, but I'll say Meeple Life Cycles. And this is where Village comes
Village.
In.
Hello.
So Village, you have your meeples and they die.
Yes, they do, with alarming regularity.
You have your meeples, and your meeples can have children, and then generations of meeples die, and then the children have children. It's really cool, I think, to create little family trees of your meeples. It adds a lot of personality to a game. And when it's done with intentionality, right, you don't want to just have it just to have it, you know, when you have it where, you know, in Village, you are managing your meeples because they will die off at a certain point. And you have to like make sure that this person is trained by this age or whatever. You want to get the most out of your meeples, right?
And you're simulating generations of life in a village. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's like a really clever thing. I mean, we see things, I think in Signore, there's some of that. But you know, one of the places that I love it the most
you say Twilight Imperium, I'll murder you.
No. And by the way, this does not include like a battle game where you're just like in a battlefield and these are coming on off. This is like the actual meeples. K2. When you're playing that game and yeah, sure, a meeple getting killed in K2 is sort of, you know, it's essentially player elimination, although you have two meeples, so you have two lives. But so you know, when you're playing that game, it doesn't feel like, oh, I got to do this, otherwise I'll get eliminated. You're thinking, I have a meeple and I have to keep this little piece of wood alive,
right,
against the elements. And I think it's really cool when you can actually assign a humanity to your little tokens there. And you know, as your guy's like climbing the mountain, you're like, should I go one tier up on this mountain? There is a snowstorm coming. What happens? You know, like and then when you push it and then your meeple dies and everyone around the table goes, aww. And you put your meeple at the bottom of the mountain. Or maybe put it there in the tent. Like, it creates storytelling, it creates fun, and
they aren't abstractions, then they're people, right?
Yeah. Oh, wait, Tom. I forgot. I'll do this one really quickly because this was actually the very first thing that I thought of, and I didn't even I don't know how I meant to not mention.
Let's be clear: you didn't number them 1 through 5 like you were supposed to.
But I'm happy with my ranking.
All right,
I'm happy.
Except that you have a zero.
I have a zero. Well, this one, this is a feature that was really cool, and this one I'm mentioning because I felt like the promise of it was not followed through, which is that in Dead of Winter there was something called the Crossroad yep. cards, and it was supposed to be a whole system that we'd see in multiple games where the person to the left of the active player would like pull a card up, and it was sort of like, if this thing happens on that person's turn, stop the game and read this. And it gives like some flavor text, but it also does things that could like impact the game. It was a really cool system. It has a lot of narrative flair and also immersion and like fun stuff
right.
to the game. And this was like 2014 or something, and the whole thing was Dead of Winter was going to be the first of many Crossroads games. And I think there was maybe like one, maybe two more. But the promise of this Crossroads thing never came to be, and I'm sad about that.
Yeah, it would have been nice.
It would have been nice.
Would have been nice, for sure. That was a really good segment, Ben. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, yeah.
Only like 5,000 games for a trade.
We named a ton of... He's not going to notate all of that. That's too much.
He shouldn't.
I don't think he can. But when you listen to these and you hear these things, if they sound intriguing to you, maybe these are games you should seek out and see if you can't try once or twice and see if you love what we're talking about. We're going to skip the game Sommelier because, well, of course, we're running.
I
have good answers too, but
all right.
What can you do?
That's all right. That was basically one giant game Sommelier we just did.
Kind of. Basically, exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/GameBrainPod, a Facebook group, Discord channel. Oh my goodness. Please get in those board game sommeliers. We love a good sommelier question. And ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson, Tom Donnelly, and Trey Alsup. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. We're on Daedalus at GameBrainPod.com. Also, thanks to Edamara Peleg for our incredible graphics. You can reach us by email at contact@GameBrainPod.com or on Twitter at GameBrain_pod. Thanks so much for listening, and go play some games with friends or make some friends with games.